Now, the interesting thing is that following these river courses down, you find traces of the more primitive groups, which we will later see, at least in part, reach this general area. The first of the people coming down here were perhaps a little less mongoloid in type than we think of the present-day Malay. They were somewhat more long-headed, had heavier features, but in general, they are enough like the mongoloids and the Malays so that we speak of them as the proto-Malayan peoples. Pushing down, they finally came into this region here, probably absorbing some of the Negro blood already here, and then began to push out, particularly as pressure of population became greater and greater, and pushed out some of them following the chain of islands, some coming north. And we find them today in such groups as the Igorot and the Ifugal in the high mountains of the Philippines, and the certain groups of the interior of Borneo, the people in the Tengger Mountains of Java, and a good many other places in this region. These people were, for the most part, if we may judge by the present groups, were people well advanced in agriculture, people who had a rice culture, which was, at least as they entered the interior, was based on terraced rice fields. They were then, or at a very early period, expert workers in iron, and in many ways were quite advanced. On the other hand, they were head-hunting peoples, peoples with a highly developed idea of spirits, ancestor worship, people who built compact villages, much at war with one another, who built rather solid houses, laid up crops from one season to another, and who were a far advance on the earlier peoples which we have mentioned. Then there came a steady infiltration down these river courses, and from the north, a steady infiltration of southern Mongoloids, who came in, amalgamated with the population already here, this proto-Malayan population, and steadily pushed along the coast, giving us the mixture which we speak of today as the Malayan peoples. Now, I would not want to indicate that all the Malayan peoples today had exactly the same background. Neither would I want to indicate that by the type of study which we have carried on that we can indicate the route by which all of these people moved. I think, however, we can say that on the basis of the studies which have been made in this part of the world by the Dutch, to a lesser extent by the French, by the British, by the Americans, dealing with the isolated groups and seeing what they have in common, we find that there is so much in common between these various groups that we can assume that a great deal of this is very old. We can also take the historic accounts, and we have historic accounts here covering a rather long period, not only that those that came with the white intrusion into this area, but the Chinese annals and other sources, which tell us that the early... Well, it was into this type of culture, in general, that we have the first known outside contacts. The first contacts that we know come in from India, and whether they came following the coast or came directly across, we do not know. But from South India, from the Pallava states of a very early period, certainly by the beginning of the Christian era, if not earlier, we have the Indian traders and petty princes coming over into this area to trade. Because knowledge of the spices, you see the greater portion of the world's spices come from the Spice Islands, the Moluccas Islands. And knowledge of these spices had reached India and even beyond. And so they were particularly anxious to have it as a recognized sovereignty rather than anything that was very real. A petty state in Java, known as Singasari, began at one time to think itself strong enough to at least defy even the semblance of a gift to the Chinese ruler. In 1292, or 91, the Chinese ruler of that period, Kublai Khan, sent emissaries down to Java and to the other states here to receive the token tribute. Singasari refused. And as the Chinese annals state, They treated the emissaries very badly. What they did was to cut off their noses and send them back to China. Well, the result was that in 92, 93, Kublai Khan sent a great fleet down to Java. It landed near the on the coast here of Java, and started inland and inflicted rather serious defeat on the Javanese forces. But while the forces were still intact, the head of a miserable little state known as Majapahit offered to assist the Chinese if in return the Chinese would recognize him as the chief ruler of Java. This was agreed upon, and the Chinese, with their supposed allies, pushed back further into the interior when the forces of Majapahit fell upon their Chinese friends and cut them to pieces. The remnants of Chinese soldiers fled back to the fleet and made their way back to China. The success of Majapahit at this time was so dramatic that it led to a very quick ascendancy of this state. And quickly they overcame all their adversaries here in Java. They spread over, they subdued Srivastava, they took over the trade of this part of the world, and they established the greatest empire of Southeastern Asia. This empire of Majapahit was not an Indian empire. There was a great deal of Indian blood in the ruling group, but it was a Hindu Javanese empire. An empire which had great fleets, which had its armies, which built roads, which had courts, which in many ways was very far advanced. They had their emissaries in China, in what we now call Siam or Thailand. It had its emissaries even in certain of the trade ports of India. This very powerful state is still one of the things which plays a very definite part in the thinking of the people of this area. These are the golden days, so far as the Malays are concerned. Then, with the fall of Majapahit, we have the division of the great court of Majapahit into two major courts, and we have the rise of another court, the second court of Matara. We haven't time to go into this more than to indicate that while the Mohammedans did away, first of all, with the Buddhistic type of architecture, which had been so stressed under Indian influence, they did away with the very elaborate art introduced by India, because the Mohammedan sect in this part of the world does not allow the depicting of any human or animal which might be worshipped, and it made great changes in that way. It broke down caste, but it did not affect the elaborate courts. These were still carried on. And many of the things that had been introduced by India were continued on under the Mohammedans. Now, while this was going on, the Mohammedanization of this area was going on, somewhat similar results were happening over further towards Europe. You all know of the pressure of the Mohammedan peoples, the fall of Constantinople, and the result. The trade routes to the Indies, whereby the spices had been filtering into Europe, or the trade had been going into Europe, were closed off. And in the search for new routes to the Indies, major things happened all over the world. Columbus, in his search for Spain, succeeded in discovering America. Vasco da Gama, for Portugal, circumnavigated Africa, came over past India and over into this part of the world. And so the sea routes were opened into this area. Search here was, again, primarily for spices. The dominant power to reach this area for a long period was Portugal. Portugal was a very aggressive, powerful, but small nation, weak in manpower. They came over into this part of the world with no idea of establishing a state. They were after trade. But they did, as they came, they found that the village of Malacca, the stronghold, or the city of Malacca, the stronghold of the Mohammedans in that region, was a key to any trade to this region. Now the Spanish and the Portuguese were just had been fighting the Moors over in their home territory, and finding the Mohammedans over here, they simply continued the holy war. And with their better equipment, they succeeded in overthrowing the Mohammedan state at Malacca in the year 1511. For the next 130 years, the Portuguese established little places they called factories leading out to this region and rigorously kept other traders out of this part of the world so far as it was possible. The English, the Dutch, and the Spanish were particularly anxious to get into this section. But they were considered pirates if they came into this territory trying to get to the spice trade. With the result that they were hunted down, their crews were massacred, and their trade goods were taken away. This idea appealed to the Malays, who also thought that piracy was not a bad business. And we have the growth here among the Malays of piracy which existed almost up to our generation. Well, the breaking of Malacca in no way stopped the spread of Mohammedism. It simply meant that the center of Mohammedan faith went over here to Johor and has been spreading steadily right up to the present day in this whole region. I think that of all of the people who came into this region, the Portuguese have probably left less impressed. Very few, you find it in Malacca, a few people, families of Portuguese name, but their imprint here was very little indeed. During the short period of their union with Spain, they were brought into war with England and with Holland, with the result that their manpower was exhausted and they retired from this part of the world for the most part. England was very busy at that time over in this region, over towards India, and Holland moved in here as the major force. But before speaking of Holland, no time for Siam and Indochina more than to indicate that the people physically are not so different from the people we have been discussing. Culturally, you have the first strong influence of India and later a tremendous amount of influence and pressure from China in this region. You have powerful, elaborate courts, and you also have very great poverty. The mass of the people living very much like the villager of the poorer class in through the Malayan region. Now Siam prides itself on being Thailand, or the land of free men. It is the one free state, until the Philippines were given their freedom, it's the one free state in this whole region here. And they have, I think, a very great deal of respect for America and for perhaps for the at least for the United Nation group. On the other hand, it is a pretty weak government. It has there's been a great deal of exploitation here. They fell very easy prey to the Japs. I don't think that we can count on them as any very great bulwark against the incursion of the communists from the north, except that we have here people who at least are temperamentally and governmentally committed to the ideals of a free land. And I think that while their sympathies would be with us, they would not be much of a bulwark, except as we can strengthen them through arms and money. But when you come to Indochina, the French section, the situation is very bad indeed. First of all, you have here a semblance of home rule. You have a native prince who has been a notorious playboy, a weak, rather corrupt native government, and you have the rule of the French over the, all of this, which has been a very weak, most of the time an exploiting, and an extremely unpopular government. It has been said for the last quarter of a century in this part of the world, the day that Holland and Great Britain leave the Indies, French rule falls. It is not a strong government. They have now the support of the Vietnam Party, which is a native party, not very strong, but which at least might be a nucleus. But coming in against this is a strong, what was a nationalistic group, but which has been definitely taken over by the communists, at least so it appears. That they have been trained by the communists, they've had communist arms, and probably have been highly trained in China, and as you know, the reverses of the French in the last days seem to indicate that you have in this region a strong communistic force, heavily armed, well-trained, that is putting great pressure on this weak and unpopular government.